Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with Bernard Rubenstein, conductor, about the Santa Fe Holguín Sister City Project. I'm delighted now to welcome back to the program David Olson. He is the artistic director of Theater Work, and the new play that is being produced at Theater Work, One Weekend Left, is Inventing Van Gogh. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much for having me again.
So this is a play, and I've always had a tremendous suspicion of plays and films about great artists, mm-hmm. because it's very easy to make a very big mess or not do the artists that you're talking about justice. And there are so many examples of that that we don't even want to start
right.
listing them. Here's a play that has taken on Van Gogh
yes.
in a pretty intense way.
It has indeed. And you're right that a mess could easily be made of such a story and such a character and such a play even. It's been a great challenge and a lovely challenge to work on this play because of the way it was shaped. And because we feel, of course, that we know this person very well in some ways.
I mean, audiences,
yeah,
because
we've
audience. Seen his work either in
yeah,
museums.
One way or the other, we feel like we know who that is, and he's the guy who cut off his ear, and you know
right.
that sort of thing.
Right, right.
We don't know much more than that. And the play really goes into not so much the story of his life, of course, but it goes into the sensibilities that emerged within his life and that kind of spill over out of his life. And that's what really attracted me to it. So it's not really an historical drama or, you know, an actor is not called upon to do some kind of an imagined impersonation, but actually to imagine, to invent Van Gogh. Just like the title says, the play is all about invention. In fact, the author wants the audience to be aware of the play being made as they see it.
Well, that's
as a work of art.
That's an interesting idea. And as you talk to the playwright, we can talk about that in a mm-hmm. moment, who thinks that the play takes place in the mind of the viewers rather
yes.
than on the stage.
Right. In other words, that the act of the apprehension of or the comprehension of art takes place in the viewer. That there is that thing that stimulates it, like in front of me where I'm sitting on the wall here, there are some pieces of art. I haven't had time to look at them closely. But there's frames and mats and colors and so on, but it would take my opening myself to them for them to fully exist as art, I think. And that's true in the theater as well. There has to be an audience present in the theater. There's no play until there's at least one person there, a stranger of some sort, who doesn't know this by heart, who isn't reading along, who is just open to just almost wandered in, you might say, and is open to it. And this playwright, in this case, is very interested in that experience, the experience of art being made right in front of. And so he's created a very subtle and complex script, really, to enact, because it doesn't follow a lot of rules. I think it's more like real life. It doesn't fall neatly into a set of patterns. It really shifts very quickly, extremely quickly, moment to moment, between one place and time and another.
When you say like real life, I mean, I think life moves in a linear way, but in your mind it doesn't. And so
yeah.
this is more like the life inside of your mind where you're going back right. and forth in time.
Or life like we're experiencing at this moment. We're in this little corner in this cafe, and we don't know the life of the people right next to us or the people right behind us or the people in the parking lot. And yet if we were to sort of somehow, say, open to their lives suddenly, or if it suddenly spilled over into our lives because it became loud or
right.
boisterous or funny or somebody started singing Happy Birthday or something, then suddenly the barriers between life, one life and another, just disappear. And we can't always control that, nor do we always want to. Sometimes we want to. We distance ourselves or close ourselves off for some reason. to be quiet or to be concentrated. But if you sit in a park, you're experiencing life at many levels all at once. And the play, it's a play. It starts at 7:30. It's over at 9:30. There's an intermission. There's a script. But it has a feeling of being just occurring, which I think is quite exciting. That's how it feels when you see it.
Now, some of the characters are set in the present day, mm-hmm. and some of them are Van Gogh and other artists,
right.
and people around Van Gogh. Do you think of these, of the Van Gogh and other characters of his time as ghosts, or how do you think of them?
I don't think of them as ghosts at all, and that's been the interesting part of it. They're not, the word apparition is used once, but it's used kidding, to be kidding, sort of, to be funny. No, I don't think so. I think it's this idea that if one has an intense awareness of something or someone, that that something or someone can become very present to you suddenly. And that doesn't necessarily have to be a cause for fear. Or, you know, there doesn't have to be sort of organ music accompanying that. We have experiences like that. We say, I was thinking of lilac. I smelled the lilacs, and I just suddenly felt my Aunt Mary. She was just like she was there. In some ways, that's true. In some ways, because of the intensity of knowing someone or being open to the presence of someone. In the case of this play, the young artist Patrick Stone has been taught by a professor who is not only an expert on the subject of Van Gogh, but really obsessed with every aspect of the life of Van Gogh, and even sort of has an unfortunate almost dependency on his idea of Van Gogh. He becomes lost in it. And so this young artist has been taught by someone who brought Van Gogh to him so strongly that at a certain moment Van Gogh is just simply present to him, not as a ghost, but just as he might be if one were aware of a character in literature, or you know what I'm saying, where something can just be very present to you. It's as though there's a veil, or a very fragile veil, between time. Times and between people who once lived and who are now gone, seemingly, and people who are now alive, and that veil just rips suddenly. And we even move in the play backwards and forwards in time, not even only between centuries, but sometimes we go forward in the life of the professor and his student, and then we go back to pick up how we got there. And so someone said about this play, it's as though time moves through the play on a diagonal rather than on a straightforward, a line moving forward. It's as though it comes in somehow diagonally. And I think that's true. Having worked on it now for weeks and having had the job of deciding how to work on it, that's my job, I tried to understand that, and I think I did. I think that the blocking, the experience of the play is clear and moving and compelling, but it's not first this happened, then that, then this, then next. But there is a feeling of a time sort of moving almost in a kind of circular way, but forward, but sort of circling back and picking up Paul Gauguin, picking up some of the characters who appeared in Van Gogh's paintings, Dr. Gachet and his daughter Marguerite, and then invented people from the present. They're all creations of the playwright. The young painter, the professor, his daughter, and the art authenticator.
Right. And there is the sense, I mean, yes, people from the past whom you obsess about become present to you. There is a word that I think the young artist, Patrick, says is that his teacher was haunted by Van Gogh, mm-hmm. and he wasn't about to do the same
exactly.
thing.
Exactly. He wouldn't allow himself to do that.
And yet he's in a dialogue with him.
But he has an experience of having several dialogues with Van Gogh, which are quite humorous and stunning. It's the kind of thing sometimes you might wish for yourself, if only I could, not necessarily Van Gogh, but someone in the past, you think, if only I could travel through time and have, and talk to that person just to get a sense of what they were like. So we do wish for that.
And there is a funny thing that happens. Many years ago, a playwright here in Santa Fe did a play about Mabel Dodge Lujan, mm-hmm. and she said that as she was writing it, it was as if Mabel were present. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that it feels... What that experience or phenomenon is, who knows, but what it feels like is that person's helping and pushing you along.
Yeah, I understand that feeling. I wrote a play about St. Francis many years ago and found myself, fortunately, I think, sort of discovered that I was being pulled towards a kind of mysticism that I couldn't and didn't want to accomplish in my life. I was a happily married person and a father, and I couldn't just give over to some mystical journey off into the wilderness, not literally, but I could feel the pull because I had to identify with the character very strongly, and I thought, in order to give him voice. So yeah, I can see how in art, maybe in other places, but in art, of course, that's not to be, one didn't have to call one's therapist or something. In art, that's to be expected, that you're pulled into understanding people, places, times, experiences, emotions that you don't necessarily feel nor want to become fully present in your own life. Otherwise, we wouldn't dare make theater. We would be destroyed sometimes. So we wouldn't dare do it.
There is this, I think, continual question about the relationship between art and madness in this play. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if you could just comment on how it's written and how you interpreted that or think about that in this play.
This is one of the reasons we're doing this play. As you have heard me say before, I look at many plays before picking a few for a season to make sure, you know, that we're doing something that the company really can grow with and all that sort of thing. But when I came to that little piece in the play in which the young artist sort of throws Van Gogh's madness into his face, you might say, as the source of his painting. Van Gogh says, if only that were true, how easy things would have been. He said, my paintings come, or his pictures, as he calls them, come from a terrible lucidity. And I when I came to those two words, when I first read the play, I stopped right there. I sat there for the longest time, thinking about it. Even now I can feel that. I was churned up, I was stirred up by those two words, a terrible lucidity, because I realized, I never thought that myself before, now I can't help but think it. I thought, yes, how true that is. And then I thought about my own career. I'm never more lucid than when I'm directing a play. Never. You know, I'm fairly lucid otherwise, but never more lucid.
Right.
Nor am I called upon to be. I can be driving down the road or sitting at home. Who cares? But I'm called upon it, I think, when I have this wonderful charge of people coming together, their talents, their imagination, their creative capacities. My task is to make something, do something, not just to be there, be expressive or something. I have to do something. And I have to be lucid. I have to be expressive in a way that others understand or are moved by, too. So when I read that in this play, I thought, I've got to do it. I think this is such an important idea that one doesn't have to lose oneself in one's art, but actually find oneself in it, if only at the moment of making it. I understand that really well, and I think it's challenging. You know, I think it defies our notion of some. Many people have a notion of artists that somehow they're wild and crazy, you know, a little nuts in order to do what they do. I don't. I never thought that, but I surely don't think that in reference to this play. So it casts a very different light on Van Gogh, which I think is fascinating in the play. We see his suffering, which was physical, mostly. I mean, it had, as far as we now know, had a physical origin. He had a form of epilepsy. he was treated with the drugs of the time that included things like turpentine, opium, so on, all in a mix. And so whatever was wrong with him became this terrible set of addictions and delirium and so on, induced by this treatment. So what we're seeing there is not, oh, well, that's what produced the art. We still have to ask ourselves would be, what art might have he produced without that?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, if he could have seen better, if he could have breathed better, if he could have not been desperately wide awake all night, you know, what might he have done? Because clearly his talent was very large. His capacity for taking paint, putting it on a brush or on the ends of his fingers. I mean, he painted 3 to 6 paintings a day. He wrote in a very short period of time over 1,000 letters to his brother, all while being treated with these hideous potions.
So-called drugs.
Drugs. And so the energy of the heart of the man are very impressive, actually. And then we also see his suffering, and we see that he died very young. He was only 37 or 38 and so on. Spent, absolutely. Look, we see his 40 self-portraits. The last few, he looks like he's 80 years old. He painted them all in about a 4-year period stretch. But the play isn't a biography of Van Gogh. We don't want to give that impression. It's really about this encounter between the young artist and this other artist, and what comes up of that encounter, and then also the people that surround these two. Some of them really trying to sort of twisting the meaning of their work, or endangering their work, or, you know, it's really quite interesting. And the playwright has all but the Van Gogh character and the Patrick Stone character are played by just 3 actors, so that these other 3 each play 2 people.
Interesting.
And we see that. In fact, by the end of the play, you're aware that they're both. You see that they don't change their costumes completely. They mix by the end. Again, with this idea in the playwright's mind that the play's the thing. In other words, that we're meant to watch a work of art being made, so that we're not meant to be swept off our feet entirely, although there are some moments, I'm told, but really to be swept into our own consciousness, into our own memory and our own layers of feeling, which is different. We're still there as thinking beings.
We're talking to David Olson about the play at Theater Work, Inventing Van Gogh, that is running Thursday through Sunday of this week. Those are the final shows. There's a recurring question in the play about what is it in Van Gogh's work that makes it glow? Mm-hmm. And it seems like that question is also a metaphor for a lot of other things.
It is indeed. It's a brilliant question. You know, some would try and answer it scientifically. They'd say, well, there's a lot of cadmium yellow, or, you know, whatever they might say. Try to sort of, we do that with everything, don't we? I mean, people try and explain what others call, some call miracles. People try and explain, well, the temperature of that water that person stepped into at Lourdes caused the muscle to contract, whatever it was.
Right.
But in this case, it's more about this idea of this question about beauty, I think. We know beauty when we see it, you know. We recognize it when we see it. But you'd almost have to ask each person, if we had time, to ask them what seems beautiful to you. Because we don't all register the same, in the same way about something that's, you know, some things are more objectively beautiful. I mean, in Van Gogh's honor, I put some irises in the lobby.
Nice.
What could be more beautiful than an iris? And it doesn't have to try very hard. It just sits there and is extremely beautiful and complex. So But in this, someone in the play says it's the presence of Van Gogh that makes the paintings glow. That's the thing that you can't repeat. In other words, you could try. The young artist is called upon, it's no secret, called upon to create a forgery. Well, how do you do that? Someone, the person who encourages that or even sort of blackmails him into doing that, gets him the right kind of canvas, the right kind of brushes, the right kind of paint, the right, you know, mixtures of oil and lacquers and things that would be scientifically
authentic.
And yet, you could give me all those things. I could not return you a Van Gogh. I'm very sorry.
Right.
I wish I could.
And really nobody could.
Nor could anyone, which is ultimately what we come to understand, you know. And it's the same thing is true in the theater. I mean, this play has been produced by other theaters in different parts of the country. I'm not talking here better or worse. I'm just talking different. There's no question that this particular, if you saw this production tonight, or on Thursday night, Friday night, flew to, you know, Austin and saw a production of it the next night, flew to Seattle and saw a production, you would see something different, essentially the same. I mean, it's the same as if somebody's, Van Gogh is painting sunflowers, Gauguin painting sunflowers, Renoir painting sunflowers, all sunflowers. But you would see something different. I know you'd have to, I think. I don't know how. Plays aren't something to which one just adds water and they appear. It takes all, you know, all those people on that stage, that whole design team and its way of seeing things. Impacts on each play, and that's why that's where live theater is such a fabulous thing. You know you're seeing something utterly unique.
And let's talk a little bit about the set mm-hmm. and the influence of the work of Van Gogh on how the set was
okay.
conceived of.
Well, there's an influence of Van Gogh, there's also an influence of what the playwright is after. So in this case, people have seen us do the chamber arrangement at the James Little before. In other words, setting up the 90-seat arrangement not using the big 300-seat arrangement in the house, but actually bringing the seats up on the edge of the stage, off the edge of the stage on platforms.
Right.
This time we have the audience on two sides of the set.
Ah.
So so that when you look through the play, you're still about 20 or so feet away from the other side, but you can see those other people, in shadow, but you see them sitting there. So you're aware of being part of a group of people witnessing a play. So that's influenced then the design. That decision was made right away to create that. It's not really in the full round, but sort of. It kind of feels like it's in the round. And so what it all starts with then is the floor, because in our arrangement you can see that everybody can see the floor from where they're sitting. The floor looks very much like Van Gogh had a hand in it. It really does. It looks like he paid a visit, and we gave him a great big roller, and off he went. And it has that feeling, and we have a brilliant lighting designer in tow as a member of the company, Jack Sherman, who the lights change every few seconds very subtly, so that what we're seeing keeps shifting and changing and being lit slightly brighter on one side or the other, because for one thing we travel through time instantaneously and we travel from place to place in an instant. So the lighting just keeps reshaping what we're seeing. And we've selected set pieces very carefully to both be able to be readable in the present, but also there are two chairs that are directly taken out of Van Gogh's paintings, his painting of the empty Gauguin chair and his painting of his own empty chair. Lots of empty chairs on the set because of Van Gogh's fascination with empty chairs, empty nests. He talked about these little empty houses, he called nests. Empty rooms, he called them. And he called chairs empty places waiting waiting to be occupied. So that's, of course, there. When we first were working on this, I thought I was going to ask the audience in the intermission to change sides and see it from a different side.
Oh, I'd love to do that.
I thought they'll never do it. They'll have found their best seat,
yeah,
and they'll have their purse on it and their coat, and they aren't going to want to do it. So we changed the set. We fooled them. The set changes around, so you're seeing it from one side. In Act One, Act One is called Yellow, and then you're seeing it from the other side, without moving, which is called Blue. So we've had a wonderful time selecting all of the objects. We have Richard Gonzalez on the job for that ever since the theater was opened here 15 years ago.
You guys are very good at this, I have to say. The objects are chosen so carefully, and they both blend and are themselves expressive.
Well, Richard and I have talked, thank you, Richard and I have talked about that many times, the idea that if an audience member gets a little distracted and ends up looking at a certain bowl, that bowl will still take them into the play, return them to the meaning, the feeling, the time of the play. So he's very careful about that. Finding everything. In this case, some things have to work in a certain way because of the way they're used. I won't reveal all of that because there have to be some surprises.
Yes.
The whole team worked very hard on this. The costumes, very effective. The costumes from the 19th century seem to be painted somewhat. They look like they stepped off of paintings. There's paint on them. The costumes from our century, of course, are just close, the right ones, but close. And that sort of thing is, of course, part of it all. This is, it's the end of our 15th season here. It's hard to believe.
Amazing.
Play number 101 in that time. Wow.
And Antigone, which we talked about also, was number 100. And what a great play to mark an anniversary.
I know.
And this one, too, which I'm looking forward to seeing. I've only read the script so far. Jonathan Dixon as Van Gogh. Mm-hmm. I ran into him a few weeks ago, just somewhere, and I didn't even recognize him.
I know he's changed.
He's transformed into Van Gogh.
He has. He's grown, of course, facial hair, but he's also, in a healthy way, over because he knew he was going to play it for a long time. He lost, 10 pounds or something. Not suddenly, but he's been, working on that in a healthy way, because I would never encourage the opposite.
De Niro excess.
No, I wouldn't do that to anyone. Ways of moving, ways of standing, colors his hair for the famous redhead. Very altered in a certain way. It's been an important role for Jonathan. It's a role he's really looked forward to for some time and has worked very hard on understanding this man. But the man in the play is not presented in just one way, as Van Gogh wouldn't have been. At one point he says, when the character Van Gogh says, Gauguin and I were, he and Gauguin shared a farmhouse for a period of time in an effort to create a kind of a community between the two of them. Two or more unlikely people for a community there could not have been. But then someone referring to that later says, oh, but the two of you worked. He said, well, actually, there weren't two of us. There were four, perhaps, maybe even as many as 12 of us with just the two of us there.
Yeah.
Because he was so multiple, this Van Gogh.
Yeah.
So the actor playing him couldn't just take a certain, had to have an essential place from which to come. But then, of course, a center. But then that center is also, of course, fractured. So it's stunning just to even watch that on the stage. Whereas you have this young American artist who's very American in his attempt to become one thing, to define himself in one way, to succeed as that one thing. It's very us. So it's a foolish quest, but anyway, that's us. And so, you have, he's very sort of undone by this multiple character person that he meets.
We're talking to David Olson about Theater Works' production of Inventing Van Gogh. So you were able to get a hold of the playwright, Stephen mm-hmm. Dietz, and talk to him about some of the ways that you were interpreting or mm-hmm. perhaps very slightly altering this play. Mm-hmm. That doesn't usually happen between directors and playwrights.
Often it doesn't. Playwrights sometimes prefer not to be bothered by everyone who's doing their play, which I understand. And I'm careful to not bother them either. I'm careful to go through channels before, you know, to let them have the chance of responding or not, because I know that could be amount to being pestered. So, but he was, the minute I did get through to an email of his, he actually responded immediately on the telephone and wanted to talk about it, and we shared the fact that we were both Minnesota boys, and we had some things to share about that lovely, fabulous period of it's still going on, I guess, in Minneapolis, of great theater being made and great risks being taken. He studied or worked at the Playwrights Center in Minneapolis, which meant hard work to become a playwright. And he set out to be a playwright and is a playwright. But because of the Playwrights Center...
He set out to be one thing.
Yes, he did. But because of the Playwrights Center, he had to do a lot of directing. And it shows. Because what comes in between the covers of his scripts is plays, not essays that are meant to be walked around and talked. So much of what one reads, now I'm not talking about the most, you know, the successful plays that have come to us, you know, Glass Menagerie, yeah, they all pass the test.
They're plays.
But so many new plays or recently written plays really are not plays at all. They just simply are not. They don't play out. In other words, they don't even seem to require it. They could just be read or read
aloud.
So what's
missing is the blocking, the drama,
the tension that can only be enacted. It can't just be spoken. The pacing. It's very well written in terms of pacing. Sometimes plays come to you and then, you know, you realize when you read them, after 40 years of doing this, I can read a play and realize, oh my gosh, that scene would seem forever. There's no breath. No one takes a breath. So this play is beautifully put together, and we talked about that Minnesota spirit, at least in our day, of adventure, of discovery, of taking a chance, you know, and all of that. So because of that, I didn't change the text at all. I just wanted to hear what he thought about certain things, a word or two. But I asked him. I never would alter a text without some kind of, pardon me, talking with someone, because you can't. I made the mistake of altering a play once a bit, taking out some lines that I thought were just too long. And said so in an interview, and we were sued.
Oh, no.
Yeah, for a lot of money.
Yeah.
So I don't do that, and I certainly would not say so if I were. But I won't. Now the easiest thing is never to do it. You just have to decide, this is the play we're doing, we'll do it. But there were some things, since I had him, and he was interested in our treatment and how we were going to handle it, and very eager now to see photographs and so on, because he wants to see what we've done with this in the round solution and all of that. Lovely guy. Just, I, you know, sometimes you get people on the phone and you can tell they're just being polite. He wasn't. He really wanted to talk, and he was interested, and he had studied our website. And he,
too bad he can't come see it.
Well, he almost did. He just couldn't swing it. He and his wife moved to Seattle from Austin every summer. They have young, very young children, and he just couldn't saddle Allison with moving the children by herself.
Right, I mean,
of course not. So anyway, he couldn't make it. But I think that, you know, we'll hear from one another more in the future. We hit it off really well. I hit it off very strangely even with Carlos Fuentes back when we did his one play. He was very aloof. But when I got him on the phone and just spoke Spanish with him, and he saw that I understood his play very well, then he got all friendly and excited and talkative. And eventually I began to feel the time ticking between what we were paying to be talking to him in Mexico City. Because it got to be, we should have been together in a cafe over coffee. We weren't. But it was interesting. He was so cold when I first spoke with him. He didn't want me to produce it. Orchids in the Moonlight, it was called in English. And so I've had all kinds of experience. You know, lovely playwrights who've come here, Nilo Cruz, Karen Zacharias, and so on, who not only approve and are interested, they've come to see it. So I like that that chance of because I know what we're doing for a playwright. Of course, they know it too. If they know what their art form is, we're making their work come to life in front of people for whom it lives on. I mean, these things to some extent live on in the consciousness of the people who see them. Not to change their lives forever, but they. Like anything beautiful lives on.
Well, and before we got on the air today, I was telling you that I've been thinking about something that's absolutely impossible to measure, but if one could only measure the cumulative effect of good theater, mm-hmm. of concerts, of music, of the arts on society, it would be fascinating, because you think all the crimes that aren't committed, all the arguments that aren't had, all right. the conversations that lead to something better,
I know.
Are what is stimulated by the arts. And you can't measure it, but you need it.
You do need it. It's one of those, yeah, I agree with you. Wouldn't it be fascinating? Wouldn't it be, you know, motivating? It would be all sorts of things, maybe even humiliating. I don't know. It's humbling, certainly, to know that. But then that's part of the deal. You don't get to know. You have to move forward assuming that your humanity and its response is enough like the humanity of others that if it moves you, it will move them. You just sort of have to come to trust that in yourself, or have people around you whose responses you trust. I'm fortunate in that way. There are people who see rehearsals, who are on book, who take notes for me and so on, who are very responsive to what they see. And so I get some measurement as we go about how it's impacting on the human spirit, at least, not always on the society, although we've done projects in towns where we could actually see, and even still hear from things 20 years ago about how a play produced in a town with the town stories changed the town.
Yeah.
We've heard it. Can't take credit for that. You can just, all you do is you put something out there and then the town makes something of it. And it's really to the credit of the human spirit, I think, that we can be moved or stimulated by beautiful things or fascinating things. If I weren't convinced that's possible, boy, what the heck would I be doing? I have no idea. Talk about mad. Drive right. me off to the local asylum.
David Olson is the artistic director of Theater Work. The play is called Inventing Van Gogh. It's this Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at 7:30 at the James A. Little Theater, and also on Sunday at 2. You can go to theaterwork.org for more information. And is there a phone number?
Yes, 471-1799 is the box office, and they can make reservations.
David, great to have you back on the program.
Okay, thank you so much.
Very happy now to welcome back to the program Bernard Rubenstein. He is a conductor, and he's the president of the Santa Fe Holguin Sister City Association. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's always a treat to be back with you.
So Holguin is Santa Fe's sister city in Cuba, and you have been going back and forth between these two cities, among other things, for a long time. What is the nature of a sister city association?
Well, Santa Fe established a sister city program many years ago, before the year 2000. And around 2000, we set up a relationship with Cuba's third largest city, the city of Holguin. And in the intervening years, many Santa Feans have gone back and forth between Santa Fe and Holguin. There have been school trips from children in Santa Fe Prep. And noted Santa Fe storyteller Joe Hayes has gone to Holguin many times. And if you go to the Holguin Library, there are books from Santa Fe. And it's many Santa Feans don't realize that we actually have a sister city in Cuba. So that's something very important that I would like to let all of Santa Fe know, that we do have this beautiful city in Cuba.
Are they like us? I mean, are they similar in size?
It's a much larger city than Santa Fe. It's the third largest city, over a million people. And if any of your listeners would like to find out a little bit more about Holguín, they can go to the City of Santa Fe website. And on the left of the webpage, there's a listing A to Z. And under Sister Cities, it lists all of Santa Fe's sister cities. We have sister cities in Japan and Bukhara and China and in Santa Fe, also in Spain. But if they click on Holguín, there's a wonderful website that Holguín has with all of the cultural things of Holguín. It's in English. And Holguín has an opera company, it has an orchestra, it has theater groups, it has children's puppet groups. It's a beautiful city. It's known, actually, as the city of parks, because every other block is a beautiful town park.
Now, what is the nature of the activities that you do together when they come here, when you go there?
Given the present political relationship between the United States and Cuba, it's very difficult now for Cuban artists to come to the United States. It takes a great deal of money.
Although Maraca is playing this Sunday,
yes,
ladies and gentlemen, in Albuquerque.
In Albuquerque. Well, in the last year, there have been more groups, but it's a very expensive venture.
Yeah.
And so right now, our relationship with Holguín has been a one-way relationship. Many people have gone to Holguín, and we brought gifts and books for the library. But we hope at some time in the future, when relations open up and the economy in Cuba improves so that there are some funds so that we can bring, for example, a puppet group to play at the Folk Museum, for example, or the opera company, it would be wonderful to bring groups from Holguín. So now it's just continuing to establish a cultural relationship to break down the cultural barriers that exist presently between the United States and Cuba.
Holguín is, if I understand it right, and I've never been there, more of a European and perhaps less of an Afro-Cuban cultural city. Is that correct?
That's correct. It's less African than the city of Santiago de Cuba, for example, which is very African. And you can, you know, you see all the African dances in the Santeria. Holguín is actually, it's the home province of Fidel Castro. But it is less Afro-influenced than a city like Santiago de Cuba.
Or Havana,
absolutely. There's also a wonderful film festival in the province of Holguín in the town of Jibara. It's called the Cine Pobre, and that's been in existence for many, many years. And I had the privilege of attending the opening festivities of the Cine Pobre Festival. And so, you know, my hope is at some point that we can bring Cuban films and have an exchange possibly between the Santa Fe Film Festival and Cine Pobre and Holguín. So these are the kinds of things that we're hoping with our sister city association.
Now, what is the status of people's ability to travel, Americans' ability to travel to Cuba? I mean, Cuba is happy to have Americans. It costs $15 at the airport to get a visa, and you can just go right in. But in terms of the United States rules, what's up right now?
This policy has recently changed. As of April 11th, President Obama has opened up travel possibilities. Now it's easier for humanitarian groups to go, for religious groups to go, and it's still a slightly complicated process. I've been going, for example, on what's called a general license for professionals who can claim officially that they're doing cultural work or professional work there. Many Americans go to Cuba without a general license, or they just travel just because of their pleasure, and there are no problems coming back to the United States.
There have been in the past.
There have
People
been
get
often
all
many
sorts of fines slapped.
I know.
Them.
Well, very often, even though I've had permission, when I come back through United States Customs, I'm called aside, interrogated. My luggage is gone through and everything, but a process can take an hour or more. This last time I said I was in Cuba conducting, doing concerts, and United States Customs agent said, fine, and I just walked through without any problems. So I think things are opening up a little bit more. There are certainly many more Cubans from the United States going without any problems whatsoever. Cash transfers are easier to go. Many Cubans are able to send more money to their families. And on my last trip, I spent the month of February in Cuba. I had concerts in Santiago de Cuba and also in Havana. and there are new restaurants opening up. Life in
restaurants?
Oh, yes. Many new private restaurants are opening up. Wonderful private things. Of course, many of them with assistance of their family and relatives in the United States. But it's amazing the number of new restaurants opening up.
Are they frequented pretty much only by foreigners?
No, also by Cubans.
Really?
By Cubans.
What's the economy like there now?
It was
terrible the last time
yes,
I was there.
Yes, the economy still is struggling. Also, something very interesting is the changes going on now with the Cuban economy. Raul Castro, who's presently the president, is trying to open up things, trying to change jobs that were primarily government jobs and to open up the private economy. So
Wait a minute, capitalism?
A kind of capitalism, yes. They're opening up golf courses. Now you can actually buy a home in Cuba with complicated procedures, but you can buy a home.
You mean foreigners can buy?
Certain foreigners. I don't know whether Americans can, but certainly foreigners, you can. Cubans,
and Cubans also?
Cubans, you used to go to the Prado in Havana, and people were exchanging homes, and there was a big on Sunday. Everyone would have a little sign saying, do you want my home? I'll trade you for this. I need a room, or I need this or that. And now Cubans can buy homes on the open market. Taxi drivers who before had to have special licenses can now pick up foreigners and drive people without worrying about being fined. So I had many excursions in Cuba with people, taxi drivers who told me, you know, last year I wouldn't have been able to pick you up and take you to this and that location, but now we're able to do so. So there are many changes going on, and it's a process. It's very exciting, actually.
That's very interesting. And we're talking to Bernard Rubenstein. Now, there's an event on, I guess, a week from today, Wednesday, June 29th, at 7 o'clock at Santa Fe Prep, where you will be speaking, and Reed Callinan, the director of the Santa Fe Photographic Workshops, and Lewis Head, who has been very active in U.S.-Cuba cultural exchanges of all kinds, will be there. Well, tell us about this event.
Well, this will be a meeting of the Santa Fe Holguin Sister City Association. And for our program, we've invited Reed Callinan, who's the director of the Santa Fe Photo Workshops, who has taken the participants in the photo workshops on many trips to Cuba. And as a matter of fact, they plan to have an association with Cuba, so they're going again this coming November. And
are they photographing other things besides 1950s Chevrolets?
I'm not certain what they're doing. It'll be interesting to see what they show. But I know they have a whole project of repeated trips in the future going to Cuba. They're setting up an association with Cuban photographers, and Cuban photography has an extraordinary history, as you well know. So Reed will be showing photos from one of their recent Cuba trips, and also Lewis Head, who is one of the founders of U.S.-Cuba Cultural Exchange, and he's very knowledgeable about Cuban affairs, will lead a discussion about present changes in Cuban travel relations and also the Cuban political and economic scene. So it should be a very lively evening, interesting discussion about everything that's going on in Cuba, and we hope this might lead to a trip to Cuba by our Santa Fe Holguin Sister City Association.
What would it take for a Santa Fean to join in such a trip?
Once we get the details, probably all it would take would be a strong interest and pay whatever travel fees that we would decide would be necessary to do it. But this is a little bit in the future. But we do hope that it should be possible. If we could either go under a humanitarian license or cultural license, but we hope this will be something we will be doing in the future.
Do you have any plans to go back and do more of your own conducting there?
Yes, I'm invited to return to Cuba next year. I'll be spending the entire month of February there.
That's a nice time. It's not too hot.
Oh, it's a beautiful time. I'll have concerts in Havana, and I'll have also concerts in Santiago de Cuba.
What is your relationship like with Cuban musicians and other conductors when you go?
It's like family. As a matter of fact, today on my email, I had three emails from Cuban musicians. They're my closest friends and wonderful colleagues. I love the Cuban musicians, and it's literally like family. I go, and they're my brothers and sisters. It's a wonderful relationship. And everyone knows that Cuba has incredible popular music, salsa and dance music. But less well-known is their excellence in classical music, both orchestra, opera, and choral music. Of course, we know there are the Cuban National Ballet, of course, is world-renowned as well.
Well, they've got conservatories like nobody's business.
Absolutely. And one thing I should mention is Holguin has an entire system of music schools, from the most elementary through an advanced conservatory. So anyone who wants to visit our sister city in Holguin can see the wonderful programs they have for music study for children.
The event is on Wednesday, the 29th of June at 7 in the evening at Santa Fe Prep. For more information, you can write to Santa Fe Holguin Sister Cities at yahoo.com or call 989-7237. Bernard Rubenstein is a conductor and president of the Santa Fe Holguin Sister City Association. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.